Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I am Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Dr. Will Trace, Lockheed Martin Fellow Emeritus and top global technology authority. Will, you have an amazing background. You've done so much over so many years, so thank you for coming in today to share your deep experiences and wisdom with the audience.
Stephen, thank you for inviting me.
Now, Will, you have such an extensive background and considerable success in so many domains that I want to focus on those lessons that will have usable value to our audience as they progress in their research and their jobs and careers and their life and so on. So let's start off with your work with DARPA in the 90s. What is the impact you see of your research and your patent?
Well, Stephen, I was principal investigator for the DARPA Domain Specific Software Architecture Program, DSSA. Our project was known as ADDAGE, Avionics Domain Application Generation Environment, and consisted of researchers from IBM Federal Systems, where I was employed at the time, MIT, Stanford Research Associates, and University of California at Irvine. Our research defined or advanced the state-of-the-art of software architecture, which led to architectural styles and patterns. Architecture description languages and module composition languages, which led to MetaAge, which led to SysML and model-based development, and domain analysis, which was the genesis of product line architectures. My patent system for identifying and linking domain information using a parsing process to identify keywords and phrases. I know that's a mouthful. Well, it was issued back in 1997, and it demonstrated how using statistical methods, commonality in multiple, and I stress multiple documents, could be automatically identified and cross-referenced by adding hyperlinks, thereby creating a domain-specific hyperlinked document. The motivation was to make software artifacts like requirement specification, design documents, test cases, and code better able to support software reuse by cross-referencing and bookmarking the domain-specific information within each artifact.
I can see that's one of the fundamental principles behind data mining today.
It's a very valuable technique.
Now, Will, what are some additional top areas of research that have had lasting impact? And can you share some lessons from these areas?
Yes. My most significant research contributions were in the areas of what was then called software reuse. I have intentionally referred to software reuse in the past tense because the term software reuse has been rebranded, and its current incarnation is component-based software development, aspect-oriented programming, software patterns, frameworks, product lines, and one more, open-source software. You ask about lasting impact and lessons learned. Well, let me tell you one real-life story that comes to mind. I was giving a two-day software reuse workshop in Irvine, California, and in attendance was a group of HP software engineers. They took away the material from the workshop and went on to create a reuse library for one of their printer lines. And, well, it turns out after a year, the project was canceled because their management didn't see any significant cost saving. But the story doesn't end there. About 6 months later, someone realized that the maintenance cost for that product line was significantly less. They were getting less calls, and it was directly attributed to the reused software, which did cost more to design, test, and document. So the lesson learned was software reuse can not only save development costs, it also saves maintenance costs if you have patience. Just a point in passing, I find it interesting to read every once in a while about software reuse surfacing on the Agile programming community blogs, but I don't want to get off track. Another lesson learned that comes to mind is, once again, going back to my DARPA days, was being invited to the first pattern workshop by the Gang of Four. I couldn't attend, but I sent one of my team members who contributed to the first patterns book, and the rest is history. Patterns are a form of design reuse. That's all comes to mind at the moment. Next question.
Just amazing, the results of your research. I mean, it's embodied in everything that's done today. Do you maybe have an update to the practitioners that are out there from this original research?
Well, I'm pleased to say, as I referred to the Agile Programming blog, that the metrics for assuming, justifying the business case for creating a reusable component has been validated numerous times independently in different programming languages and different programming paradigms. So that, you know, it basically, the break-even point is designing and testing for software that has the potential for reuse. The payback is after about 2.3 times. So if you invest that extra effort in generalizing, documenting, testing, what have you, you will get a return on investment for software reuse, a reusable component. And I think that's interesting to see.
Again, Will, you have this really considerable history of success. And let's now talk about your past industry roles. So can you overview them and explain how you succeeded in each role?
Well, where do I start? If I understand the question, I can address some of the challenges or opportunities that were presented to me in my 38-year career that spanned basically four technology areas: real-time embedded software, microprogramming, microarchitectures, software architectures, and then on to enterprise architecture. I was the IBM Microprocessor Integrated Technical Liaison Chair. It's a focus group. That's what IBM called it back then, when reduced instruction set processors, the 801 or ROP chip, which is currently known as the PowerPC, was under development. Suffice it to say that back then, the 801 had other microprocessor competitors, and this led to some very interesting technical as well as political debate. The real challenge, though, was to convince the mainframe manufacturers in Poughkeepsie that the PC had potential, it wasn't a threat, and I guess I didn't necessarily succeed to the fullest extent in that role, but it was a valuable lesson learned about disruptive technology, organizational change, and how to deal with it. Moving on, I was a member of the IBM Software Reuse Council, and one of the challenges was to develop a zero-defect library of reusable component, a software component. We succeeded by taking a rather unique approach. We implemented the design twice, two different groups, one in ADA and then in PLC, two different test cases, and the result was, well, that set of reusable components never had any defect. Very successful. Currently, I am the Lockheed Martin Strategic Industry Association liaison to ACM and the IEEE Computer Society, responsible for identifying and promoting technical resources that can be leveraged by Lockheed Martin engineers. For the IEEE Computer Society, I have successfully coordinated and moderated over a dozen webinars. And for ACM, I've recently joined the ACM Professional Development Committee. I've created a discounted or negotiated a discounted membership website for Lockheed Martin employees and helped establish the ACM webinar series. All of these provided additional professional development opportunities to Lockheed Martin engineers.
Now, I'm fascinated with all of these roles that you've had and continue to have an impact throughout the world, really, with your industry roles. And I just wanted to mine this area about, you know, the organizational change caused by disruptive technologies when you were with the IBM sort of microprocessor group. So how did you specifically deal with that organizational change?
How did I deal with that organizational change? As I alluded to, I did my best by presenting an objective evidence, thoroughly reviewing the market, identifying the market potential, the competition, and showing the utility of the technology as it fit in the current, if you will, software development as well as commercial is not the right word, home computing potential. And, you know, we had an IBM 360 on a desktop back in the late 70s. But once again, it was perceived to be too early, or it might detract from the economics of the mainframe business area, and that risk was not, I never had overcome that that hurdle, and in fact, I was told to basically stop campaigning and that others would address the issue at the appropriate time. Not sure that, well, we can see that it played out its course the way it did. and that the ROM chip lives on, the PowerPC, so in some sense there was successful hardware incorporation of the technology at the time, but into the mainframe, but IBM days and the personal computer have long passed on.
It's interesting when you share that story, it kind of reminds me of some of the work that occurred at DEC and how that, you know, they really didn't also address the PC shift, and it created some concern within the organization and challenges as well. Now, you talked about your work with the ACM and the ACM Professional Development Committee, and you helped establish the webinar series. How are you going to further contribute on the webinar side?
Well, the opportunity is to, there are several opportunities, and the question is, how do you prioritize the opportunities in order to maximize the benefit to members and professionals in software engineers, software developers, software managers? And I like to include software managers. I also like to include, you know, information technology. I want professionals because I think just my background, as I alluded to, was started off in real-time embedded computing, and that still is an important aspect with mobile computing in the marketplace. But, you know, large enterprise architectures, how do we balance out selecting the topics? And there's never a risk of running out of resources. ACM, for example, has their lecture series, and there are numerous speakers who we probably will tap into. And you know, personally, the members of the Professional Development Committee are well connected, well established, have networked with several industry leaders, well-recognized researchers, so I'm confident that we will not run out of ideas, nor will we run out of individuals to participate in the webinar series. And I'm looking forward to that. And as a afterthought, I will just point out to our listeners that those webinars are currently open to the entire community. You don't have to be a member of ACM to listen to them, and they are a valuable resource of interest to keep your finger on the pulse of technology.
Well, you're an acknowledged expert in enterprise architecture. In fact, you have a great history in that area. So can you share some best practices from your experiences with enterprise architecture?
I'm not sure I'm that much of an expert, but I will definitely be glad to share with you some of my experiences. And the risk of overstating the obvious, the three best practices that do come to mind from my experience, I'm sure they are biased by, once again, my personal experience with enterprise architecture problems that I supported. In any case, they are first, seems to be a recurring theme. Change is inevitable. You need to plan for it. And now I'm not just talking about planning for new technology or an incorporation of new capabilities. I'm also talking about organizational change. And I would refer our listeners to ITIL documentation. They have a good module on that particular topic. Number two, the best practice or lesson learned is that security can't be bolted on to be integrated into your enterprise architecture from the start. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. There are many aspects of security, and actually that leads nicely to number three, which is a process related to security as well as a technology best practice, and that is IDAM, Identity and Access Management. This cannot be an afterthought. You need to identify who administers it, how it's administered, and that's just as important as having the right products, because all other capabilities end up using it when delivering enterprise services. These IDAM scenarios of administering accounts, administering rights, need to be well thought out and planned for as part of any enterprise architecture strategy. If I was to summarize, then I would say that while having a robust enterprise architecture and a realistic IT portfolio management plan, those are important, but delivering more capability is not as important as delivering it well, and that one really needs to focus on the other ILATs, usability, scalability, security, maintainability, etc., for example.
You also have an extensive history in software engineering, so what best practices can you share from that extensive experience?
Well, this is an interesting question, and I wonder how I would have answered it 5 years ago or 20 years ago. If I think about it for a minute or two, I would hazard to guess. In some areas, I would answer it pretty much same way, but use slightly different buzzwords. My top three best practices in no particular order then would be, well, number one, what is called test-driven development today, and regardless of whether you approach it from an agile development perspective or not, getting the test cases right and the test data right implies you understand the requirement, and I'm not just talking about the happy path testing, that is, testing the capability is there. It's important to test for what can go wrong. Number two would be design patterns and anti-patterns, which are a form of design reuse, that is, raising the level of abstraction, codifying design rationale so that you have confidence that you are making the right design decision and can avoid making mistakes. By the way, I'd like to point out there's a lot of good work on anti-pattern. They're called archetypes, being done by the Software Acquisition Group at the Software Engineering Institute at Carnegie Mellon University. I happen to have been on the technical advisory board there for several years, and I would recommend checking them out. It's a hidden gem. Finally, I would have to say design for change, probably better called software sustainability as I think about it, basically establishing a clear understanding of the problem space and the solution space and documenting the trade-offs and design decision rationale so that if technology matures or new capabilities are required or replaced, they can easily be addressed. How's that?
Now, those are excellent best practices. What do you think the penetration of these best practices are in the marketplace? Do you think that the majority of software engineers are following them?
The majority of software engineers? Well, yes, I think the majority of software engineers are developing, but not the majority of software developers or programmers. And this is just a soapbox that I get on every once in a while to talk about the difference between computer science and software engineering education, and also the professionalism in our community, and whether the software developers, software managers recognize the value of you can do it right the first time, or you can do it over. And there are trade-offs in time to market, but I think that what's interesting is to see some of the trends in open source software and the focus on quality that is maybe changing that the return on those marketing decisions. We'll just leave it at that. Okay.
We got a bit of hint of this earlier in our discussion, but how has your background in microprogramming and microarchitecture influenced your thinking into the future?
That was quite a while ago, and not to date myself too badly, but my first job at IBM was support of the microcode on the space shuttle computer and other avionics platforms. This job eventually led me to becoming the chair of ACM's special interest group on microprogramming and the general chair of the 25th annual workshop on microprogramming, where I was fortunate to organize the first RISC versus CISC debate, that's reduced instruction set computer versus complex instruction set computer. It was held at Stanford back in the early 80s. And what's interesting is that I see the same cost, schedule, performance trade-offs that were discussed in this debate at the microarchitecture level, just as there are currently cost, schedule, and performance trade-offs being discussed at the enterprise architecture level. So the bottom line is that I believe it's been to my advantage to have a deep understanding of computers and information technology infrastructure from the silicon level up to the SOAP and enterprise services level. And the second benefit was my involvement in professional society activities and realizing the importance of networking at conferences and other avenues.
If you were to sort of quantify sort of the value of networking at conferences, and you just talked about that, would you say that's something that IT professionals should put maybe 20% of their time on, or 30% of their time, or 10%?
It's hard to put a number because obviously there's a return on investment. There's often one has to make the personal decision on whether there is a fertile ground to plow, so to speak, and a return on one's investment. But I'd say as a minimum rule of thumb, as a Lockheed Martin fellow, we're encouraged to spend at least 10% of our time networking and maintaining, using the expression, our finger on the pulse of technology. And the best way is to not take a too incestual look at who's developing technology, but need to branch out and network and maintain a list of outside sources to better understand the what's emerging and on the horizon or over the horizon as far as technology.
So we talked about various aspects of your background. What have we missed?
Probably my warped sense of humor. I have a collection of probably thousands, if not tens of thousands, of jokes that seem to have worked their way into my memory and have not escaped. So let's just say you need a sense of humor to survive in this field, and it is a great way to also hold meetings and to hold everyone's attention. So with that said, you also have to be a visionary and willing to know how to set your priorities and how to be tactful in telling someone they are wrong. And then again, to graciously accept constructive criticism and to not take it personally, to not be afraid to admit you're wrong and to make mistakes. Just as a humorous or ironic personal anecdote, and I know that this will date myself, but my background in computing started with my first computing course, which I took as a sophomore undergraduate in 1970. It involved punch cards and programming in Fortran 2 on an IBM 1130. The course instructor was a chemistry professor who said, write a program for your final project. And, well, my final project, I designed and implemented a taxi cab dispatch system that assigned cabs to clients based on their current location and traffic conditions, had a rudimentary map built in, and not only did it tell the cab driver the pickup and destination locations, but we gave them the best route to get there based on, once again, current traffic condition. Well, that was 40 years ago. I know a little bit ahead of its time, but at the time it seemed obvious that that was a good idea, but this is not the point of the story. You see, point of the story is I received a low grade in the course, and when I went back and told the professor that I could teach the course, she said, okay. So for my junior and senior year, I was a teaching assistant running study groups and labs for the introduction to computer science course. One more thing as an example of humor in my book, Confessions of a Used Program Salesman, which probably you could interpret as a bit of humor. I state the reason that I named my daughter Meg was that she was worth a million. Okay, enough. Next.
Now let's talk more about this book, Confessions of a Used Program Salesman. I mean, it sounds fascinating. Are you going to do an update?
Well, maybe. But it was translated into Japanese, and actually it's still selling fairly well, rather than the American, the English edition. So, you know, the information in it, the subtitle of the book was Institutionalizing Software Reuse, and a lot of the processes that we developed and documented as part of the domain-specific software architecture and have been incorporated in the second half of the book. The first half of the book, I like to joke, contains many pictures, caricatures, and so, as I said, I like to joke that even a manager can get something out of the book. Don't have to read it, just look at the pictures. So, I think it's still relevant. I think that it's still a good read, and be happy to talk to anybody who would like to, or if they're having trouble getting a copy, I'll talk to them about specific topics.
Well, you've been an editor of ACM SigSoft Software Engineering Notes for 18 years, and what have you seen that has changed?
Well, that's sort of a loaded question. A lot sure has changed. Technology, tool, people, presidents, the cost of a gallon of gasoline, the color of my hair or lack thereof, but I know that's not what you mean. Let's see. On the positive side is the editor. The production process has changed a lot, and that sort of reflects how technology, the internet, and social media has changed. I used to compose each issue by hand by assembling printouts of short papers that were sent to me on floppies or in hard copy. This evolved to an all-electronic submission and publication process, but eventually we changed format to become a hybrid publication where abstracts only appear in print and full papers were placed in the ACM Digital Library. It's much smoother process now. Content-wise, some things haven't changed. We still have Peter Newman's risk column because, well, people still, I won't say people, probably they're a decision of many, still haven't learned the differences between a software engineer, a programmer, or a person who can program well. And again, I digress. I apologize. Actually, this is a good segue to point out one of the recent columns on the difference between a computer science degree and a software engineering degree that appeared in the software engineering education column of the last issue. And in the last issue, we also had a column on big data, a very relevant topic in today. And in the next issue, we have a column on technical debt, both in our Surfing the Net column by columnist Mark Dornhofer. On the negative side, I'm sad to say there has been an increase in plagiarism, which I attribute to lack of ethics being stressed in colleges today and the easy access of digital material on the web.
So on that last part, on the negative side, what do you see as solutions to shore up ethics? And
Well, as we, shoring up ethic is a there's two sides of that coin. The first is personal professionalism and accountability, and the second is corporate accountability. And so unless we recognize the importance and can somehow or another enforce the violations, now ACM has a very well-defined policy for dealing with plagiarism, and they define it clearly as in several, if you will, degrees of offense. And, the last example of plagiarism that I was faced with resulted in the dismissal of the PhD candidate from their program. And so, where be it somewhat of a drastic result, nonetheless, it is important as an example for others to know that there are repercussions of their actions, that their decision could adversely affect their careers.
As editor for 18 years of this significant publication, what notable software engineering best practices then can you highlight from the ACM 6 software engineering note?
Best practice. Well, in 18 years, there's a lot of water that has gone over the dam, so to speak, and I would say the best place to look for best practices, advice, insight on software engineering would be in the Surfing the Net column I previously mentioned, where Mark has discussed, normally in 10 pages, so it's very easy read or less, topics such as big data, as I mentioned before, open source software, security, search, multi-core computing, agile computing, mobile computing, cloud computing, scripting languages. This column really provides a great intro to resources on the web on these topics. And as a advertisement, I guess, the complete list of topics is available on the ACM 6 Software Engineering Notes website. The next best place to get advice, and this is advice that brings sort of a smile to your face, very normally one and a half page type read, would be our frontline or in the trenches columnist Mike Wing. Anything he writes is entertaining, enlightening, and sometimes painfully poignant. His style is reflective, concise, and sort of been there, done that, didn't like it at times. My favorite article, and one I highly recommend, dealt with the worst software development manager in the world, and it's sort of a lessons learned of what not to do and how, though well-intentioned and perhaps somewhat egotistical the manager was, his desired results were not achieved by his particular style. Finally, if you want to learn about security and safety best practices or learn from mistakes of others, you can read the Peter Neumann's risk column. I don't know whether I really answered your question, but like I said, there's a lot of water going over the dam, and searching the ACM Digital Library would give you, for a particular topic, should give you good results.
Now, we talked about your book briefly, so let's mine into this or drill into this a little bit further. You know, your book, Confessions of a Used Program Salesman, contains some rather humorous perspectives on software engineering. What has changed in the 15 years since it was published?
Yes, it has been a rather long time, and those who, the expression, those who can't learn from the past need to repeat it. So let me focus on what has changed with respect to software use, and we'll see what hasn't changed in the last 15 years. So let me start off by stating somewhat dramatically that software reuse officially died as a research topic 12 years ago when the steering committee for the Symposium on Software Reuse, which I happened to be the chair of at the time, declared that all technical research issues regarding software reuse had been solved, and we terminated the conference. As radical as that may seem, theme. The challenges software reuse have not gone away, of course. Software reuse continues to be viewed by many as a silver bullet, but little do people realize that they still need what I refer to as a golden gun to shoot the bullet out of, and that, well, silver bullets do cost more than regular bullets, and sometimes the caliber of the bullet doesn't match the barrel of the gun, so you need some glue. But this is turning out to be an advertisement for one of the book, one of the chapters in my book, so I'll leave that metaphor there. My point is that software reuse lives on, reincarnated now as component-based software development. There have been at least 10 software-based development conferences that I know of that have picked up that focus. There is aspect-oriented programming, which is one dimension of software reuse. In other words, trying to match the caliber of the bullet to the barrel of the gun is an integration mechanism. And what most encouraging is advances in software service-oriented architecture and open source software component framework. But in my not so humble opinion, the biggest advance to making reuse a reality was SOAP, Simple Object Access Protocol, which relies on XML, of course, because what was missing in the early days of reuse, other than critical mass, was the glue to connect the components together and a standard to describe their interfaces, which SOAP and XML have provided.
Let's now focus on your role as General Chair ACM SigSoft, FFC 2012. How will you measure success, and what is the value to participants?
Well, as general chair of the Foundations of Software and Engineering Conference that will be held this November, I've been reminded by the sponsoring organization, ACM SigSoft, that the financial success of the conference is always a concern. But in reality, it was my responsibility to choose a site, a location to hold the conference. I think the location we ended up with, which is Research Triangle Park in North Carolina, is ideal because it has easy international access as well as a large local academic and industry community. My personal goal is to encourage student participation, especially from the students at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Duke, and North Carolina State, which are all locally located close by. Also, I'm reducing the registration fee for students significantly to assure that they can reap the benefits of witnessing the future directions of software engineering research that will be discussed. Finally, I can't help but mention that we have an outstanding conference committee. Over 200 papers have been submitted, so it looks like we'll have a top-shelf program, and I would like to point out the keynote speaker is going to be one of the software architects from the IBM Watson project, which I think really the area, the frontiers of software engineering, software architecture that were pushed in that project will have an impact on technology for the decade to come.
I mean, that sounds like a great opportunity just to get engaged, and I would highly recommend everybody to look into it.
All are welcomed, and if anybody needs any explanations, just go to the website. We do arrange for visas for if necessary, and ACM has a very well-tuned machine to support registration.
Well, can you overview your other nonprofit contribution roles and some lessons you can share from each of these roles?
Oh, sure. Let's see. I've been on the Rochester Institute of Technology Software Engineering Department Industry Advisory Board for the last 10 years, and as I mentioned, I was on the Software Engineering Institute's Technical Advisory Board. I'm also a member of the ACM Professional Development Committee. So let me talk about the RIT Advisory Board first. The RIT Software Engineering Department had one of the first, if not the first, ABET-accredited undergraduate software engineering degree programs in the country. I felt one of the strengths of their program was the involvement of myself and other members of the Industry Advisory Board in providing curriculum development feedback as well as supporting senior class projects. The importance of providing real-world contact to their classroom experience was invaluable and made them highly qualified and desirable graduates. Next, I've been on the ACM Professional Development Committee for a little over a year, and I must say that I'm really impressed on how much we've been able to accomplish, partially due to the high caliber of the members on the committee, but also by the willingness of ACM staff to act on the suggestions of committee members. It's been a true win-win situation for me. I know the engineers in my company have benefited from the ACM Tech Packs, Learning Packs, and webinars that the members of the PD that I've worked with have proposed, developed, and reviewed. One final anecdote with respect to the Software Engineering Institute, and actually let me start off with a joke told by one of my DARPA program managers. It goes like this. There was a married couple, and they came out of a restaurant one night to find a man on his hands and knees, obviously looking for something on the ground. They asked him, what was he doing? And he said he was looking for his car. They asked if they could help him, and he said, sure. And then they asked, where was it that he last thought he had his keys? And he said, over there by his car. They then ask him, why was he looking for the keys over here, not over by his car? And he said, because the light was better under the street light. The moral of the story is that oftentimes researchers look for answers in the wrong place because it is easier, and that as a member of the Technical Advisory Board at SEI, we had the opportunity, let's say, to identify and prioritize problem areas that were not being addressed and that had a higher return on investment.
I don't know. You just make me smile with these stories. That was great. And they very much spotlight the point you're trying to make, too. So, okay, now you talked about the ACM Professional Development Committee, and I guess this sort of ties into this concept called the ACM Learning Center and the ACM Tech Packs, ACM Learning Paths, and the ACM Webinars. Why should computing professionals utilize all of these facets of the ACM Learning Center?
Well, that's a nice follow-up question, yes. Well, it was once pointed out to me that current technology becomes obsolete in about 5 years' time. And I'm not sure whether that statement was made before the concept of Internet time, so it may be even shorter than that. My observation is that oftentimes the state-of-the-art may become state of the practice. It might take that long, depending on early adopters and the like, but that it is the state of the possible that changes yearly, and that in order to be competitive and innovative, you need to do a personal technology refresh yearly, free of the marketing hype. And one of the best ways to do that is to take advantage of the resources in the ACM Learning Center with its tech packs, learning paths, webinars, which, by the way, currently do not require an ACM membership to access, not to mention all the Safari books and Element K/Skillsoft courses that are available to members.
Will, you're such a valuable contributor to all of those components of the ACM Learning Center. Can you kind of differentiate what tech packs are versus learning paths and then webinars?
Yes. The way I explain it to when I need to promote it within my company is that a tech pack is, once again, pick a topic such as cloud computing, and it's an annotated bibliography. So it's a set of papers, topics with links to them, and it basically provides the user with a set of resources to self-familiarize yourself, self-learn on a particular topic. Sort of similar to SWEBOC, which is IEEE software book of knowledge. The learning paths are more focused on a particular programming language, in particular Ruby, for example, and they're a series of, once again, a resource that shows you where to, on the web, pick up courses or self-learn and become more proficient, maybe self-test and yourself on your knowledge or advance your knowledge on a particular programming language in this case. Did I answer the question?
Yes, absolutely. And how do webinars fit in?
Well, webinars are a recent addition to the ACM Learning Center, and they are scheduled, 4 to 6 weeks in advance. You get an announcement, and it provides the professional with an opportunity, if it is to subscribe to the real time, meaning you actually listen to the speaker and have the opportunity to interact by asking questions. So this differentiates between a podcast where it is a post-processing, and it's sort of between the moderator and the speaker, you get the to hear the playback. And of course, the webinars are recorded and are available for download and listening to. But this dynamic aspect of a webinar is what's unique and timely. So the webinars are meant to provide you with the most current view of the state of the art or state of the practice from the experts who are defining the state of the art or supporting the state of the practice in innovative ways?
Well, you have 4 degrees, math, computer science, computer engineering, electrical engineering. How has that helped you in your career, and what would you have added?
What would I have added? Well, I never got an MBA, and I agree that part of as you advance in your career, you become less and less hands-on twiddling the bits and more on working with people to and providing them insight and direction. And there's an expression, in order to walk the walk, you need to talk the talk. So in my opinion, investing as much time as I did in these disciplines has helped me understand the big picture, to be better prepared to connect the dot, to communicate, to define and express requirements, do technology trade-offs, have the tools to perform analysis, and to provide solutions to some challenging multidimensional, multifaceted software and systems engineering problems. In addition, I do have to admit, I don't know whether reluctantly, but, there's some level of credibility that comes from those degrees that helps sometimes in negotiating trade-offs, opening doors, and the like.
Which one of those degrees do you think provided the greatest challenges, and which one do you think provided the greatest opportunities for you?
Good question. Well, greatest challenge was definitely, since my order of degrees was math, computer science, computer engineering, electrical engineering, if I had to do it over again, I would have liked to have dealt in, put the electrical engineering earlier in the process. So I think that was the most challenging. As far as rewarding, all of them had, when you spend so much time in the classroom, there were programs or classes that in each of those universities that I really liked and had longstanding payback. But what comes to mind, probably the course that I said to myself, this is a great course. I can hardly wait to get to university and actually teach the course. And that would be, and I probably don't remember the title, but it had to do with networking. It had to do with actual communications protocols, networking. At the time, I had to implement a token ring protocol, but going up and down the stack, understanding and how that particular, how the Internet works today, was to me the most rewarding and of the courses that come to mind.
Yeah, that's an interesting insight. I didn't expect that.
Well, I did enjoy my management course that I took as an undergraduate with Pavlov's need hierarchy. No, that's Maslow's need hierarchy, and that just helped me understand, how to work with people and how to motivate people. And like I said, if I had gone back to an MBA, I'm sure I would have picked up on that. And then on my own, studying ITIL, that was, and as anybody can, there's a lot of material that's available on the web, and that really helps you as a IT professional, as well as just a software developer, understanding and prioritizing and working with other people in the bigger process of software production, sustainment, and operation.
Now, let's broaden that question, the last question, in the sense of, in all of your past roles, what were your biggest challenges and their solutions?
Biggest challenges. Well, I'd say the biggest challenge was balancing personal life with work responsibilities. I think we all can get immersed into our work, verge on being a workaholic, and I know I just made my million-mile flyer mark on United, so spend a lot of time away from home and in seats on airplanes or in hotels. So the biggest non-technical challenge and the solution is that then is making sure you have your priorities straight and knowing when to say no. From a non-technical perspective, I think organizational change management has always been the biggest challenge. Getting people to switch from what they've been using to a new process and technology is challenging, and I rely on my ITIL change management material relied on that to create change programs with metrics, training, incentives, reinforcement, recognition, etc. And notice I did say metrics first. Technically, the biggest challenge has been separating reality from marketing hype. And you have to do that when you evaluate vendor products. The most interesting projects that I've led focused on defining requirements for documenting, analyzing, and recommending a product that would provide a certain capability for my customer. I followed a well-defined process, collected relevant metrics, defined and refined evaluation criteria and weights, and developed sensitivity models. I say models because you need several models. And let's just say that if you have confidence in the process, in the metrics, and your analytical model, then you will have confidence in the result.
In your career, has there been one situation where you've done all the required sort of background, but it just didn't work out?
And yes. And it was for a very, I will just say, let me just provide the example. It was, we selected a product for a particular customer that had the capabilities, and then independent, we were not involved in the actual integration configuration of the process, but that was another contractor. This was for the Air Force. And the contractor, as much as we had provided them guidance in realizing that they were targeting to a Unix environment, they chose to develop on a Windows environment, and they chose to do that independently of the security and the identity and access management services that were on the enterprise architectures that they were eventually needing to field on. And guess what? They got the product to configured with the data to address the business model that they needed to support, but they could never get it under the budget that they had or the schedule they had to integrate into the enterprise architecture. And so we warned them that, you know, this bow wave effect, that's bow wave, by the way, is one of the archetypes that the software acquisition group at the Software Engineering Institute talk about, is how you continually push off the hard problems till the end, and in the sense of making progress. So they made great progress, as they say, got the 90% of the capabilities in place, and then with 90% of the budget, but then, well, they ran out of time, ran out of money, and never were successful in the most important aspect, which was integrating it into the enterprise architecture. And you've heard me talk about the ILITES and the importance of IDAM, Identity and Access Management, and having that those scenarios fleshed out, identified, and properly planned for early on.
Well, you are one of the most influential thinkers and thought leaders in this field, and, you know, and it really impacting business and industry, governments, academia, and so on. And in your prior career, you were responsible for evaluating new technologies in its application. So I think you're perfectly situated for this next question. And that is, from this experience, from all of these different domains you worked in, all this incredible education you have, all the remarkable roles you've played and how you've impacted the world, can you provide your predictions of some future IT trends and their implications and opportunities?
Well, I don't know how focused my lens is as far as providing insight into new technologies and applications. I like to review the Gartner predictions yearly to see how they map into my understanding of the maturity of certain technologies and our ability to integrate it and deliver capabilities. So in no particular order, I'm just going to go down a list of some things that come to the top of my head. And the one that I most recently was impressed with and thinking that this is going to make a difference. And I'm going to say it carefully. So my best guess is computation in the cloud. So this is not necessarily cloud computing, because obviously that's the trend that everybody is well aware of and it's easy to predict. But I'm talking about the opportunity for new, I'll use the word affordable, capabilities that were previously not practical for solutions to incorporate, to integrate in their delivering capabilities to their end users. So computation in the cloud, that's number one. Number two, and probably no surprise, heuristic analysis techniques for big data. I have a brother-in-law who is the chairman of the machine learning department at Carnegie Mellon University, and I have these interesting discussions at family gatherings, probably much to the dismay of my wife, but that we talk about advances in machine learning and where some of the breakthroughs have been and what the technical barriers are. So I think some of those barriers have been broken down or are in the process of becoming less of a hurdle. So we'll see advances in those heuristic analysis for and machine learning. Okay, easy target, low-hanging fruit would be open source software. More of it becoming available and the quality is improving. It really definitely shifts the equation away from COTS product. Makes that decision more attractive. Next, and maybe it's a long shot, and you'll see why, is self-adapted, self-aware, and self-healing systems of systems. This is the autonomic computing effort that IBM set forth about 8 years ago, which actually happens to correspond with the International Conference on Autonomic Computing that's coming up in June. This also was the last DARPA project that I worked on over a decade ago. I think the technology is ready to move out and move out of the laboratory and production, and I'm confident we'll see some tangible impact soon. The last area where I see progress is better tools for automated program analysis. IVNV is obviously time intensive, and systems are getting too complex to rely on manual techniques. So there's been some very good automated program analysis method techniques, tools that are coming out of universities that are getting commercialized, and where be it they have perhaps more of a narrow domain of applicability, they are. It's exciting to see, and back to my emphasis on quality, as we introduce more and more complexity and more non-determinism in our systems, we definitely need automated techniques, and we need to build into our systems this self-awareness to assure graceful degradation when problems do occur and ensure continuity of operation. So that's about it.
Again, sort of as an extension to what we've been talking about here and providing your predictions of future IT trends, do you foresee particularly disruptive innovation?
Let's see. What's on the horizon? What's over the horizon? It's a good question. I wish I had a good answer, but I will speculate because there is something that for IT that I have often, connecting the dots, saying this might actually have serious potential. And that is complex event-driven computing. And not that it's partially attributable to my PhD thesis advisor at Stanford, but, it really could be a disruptive technology that, I think, assuming we can get it to scale, will really make our IT processing better able to respond to new capabilities and increased maintainability and the like. But it's assuming we can get it to scale, which was one of the greatest challenges of the Japanese fifth generation computing project back in the 80s. Now, I was particularly fascinated by the Japanese fifth generation computing project, understanding the technology, their goals, and exactly what they were trying to accomplish. And I think to some extent, the IBM Watson project has addressed many of those issues. Now, speaking of scale, everybody realizes that scalability is one of the most important attributes of cloud computing. And as I mentioned earlier, I foresee the introduction of new innovations, innovative software services that can be used to provide new capabilities, maybe virtual reality. Well, I realize this might not be disruptive. It would be fun, and it would definitely make gaming more attractive. Not that it isn't attractive or seductive enough right now. And then there is quantum computing. That is something that's been discussed for a while, and maybe it's closer to reality, but right now it's being focused on and applicable to certain types of applications that are not necessarily IT, although I know that business analytics, business intelligence could definitely be an application area for quantum computing, but I'm not sure exactly when that will be. So that's about it.
We're now going to switch directions here, and we're going to talk about this whole idea of quality and measuring quality and quality assurance and you have these professions like accounting and medicine and law, and then you have computing, which is somewhat fragmented right now. And so what are your thoughts then as computing as a recognized profession with demonstrated professional development, adherence to the code of ethics, recognized perhaps non-licensing-based credentials so that there is some sort of quality assurance or risk management or risk mitigation and so on?
Yes, I'm trying to think back when I was involved in intellectual property rights discussions as well as engineering licensing discussion, and there was a conference. I lined up a speaker who was a lawyer who talked about IP as well as which states require, limit the use of the word engineer, it's just Texas, to people who are licensed engineers, and how the first licensed software engineers were in Texas, if I have that, my memory serves me correctly. But I do commend the goals of the National Professional Practice Partnership and the ACM and IEEE Computer Society on their code of ethics and what they're trying to do to raise the standards for professionalism. I also think there's a strong need for certification or to the point of licensing for software developers, software engineers. As I stated earlier, there can be a big difference between what a software engineer can do, a computer programmer, and a person who can write programs. Not that all software developers need a degree in software engineering or computer science, but since software is the engine driving the world's infrastructure, there is a strong need for accountability for actions. And that comes, I'm not sure if you say just from professionalism, but it also comes from following a code of ethics, which would make you highly professional. I don't want to overstate the obvious, but we have a checkered path, and that can be illustrated by the risk column of each issue of Software Engineering Notes that contain close to easily 100 examples each issue of software failures that probably could have been avoided with better trained software managers, developers, and testers. But it will be hard to overcome market pressures that still result in shortcuts on quality. The bottom line is that having a legal system and a public opinion that demands quality is the only way things are going to change.
Now, I really commend you on your perspective, considering that you are and have been in the trenches for so many years. What is it, 38 years?
Yes.
And so you've seen it all somewhat, and all the roles that you played in industry and in the associations and so on. So thank you for your insights in that area. Now, in the next question, I'm going to get you to share your deep insights on each of the following, and that is, I want your candid thoughts on emerging technologies from the perspective of a CIO versus a CTO. And the perspectives are in five areas. One is which technology to grow revenue versus technology to increase efficiencies. The next would be impact on business driving the technology decision. The third would be on technology perspectives from the customer's point of view. The fourth would be, are CIOs become the chief information officer? And then the fifth would be, what are some other hot topics where there can be a discussion of CIO versus CTO and thoughts on emerging technology. So if you can address the first one, and that is technology to grow revenues versus technology to increase efficiencies from the perspective of CIO versus a CTO.
Yes. Not sure how many deep insights I have on this, but I'll be happy to share what I can. Again, I'm not sure how much I can add to the current wisdom, but technology to grow revenue versus technology to increase efficiency. I faced this game in proposal writing on how you propose a solution that is going to not only grow revenue but increase efficiencies, and exactly what exactly would be in that particular context. So technology can do both, but of course technology has a cost, and there can be long-term and short-term gains from cost avoidance and cost savings without, let me stress, even adding new capabilities, because there is a potential to increase revenue by increasing market share by lowering the cost of services. So my best answer is it depends. Depends on the technology and the business case. Take cloud computing, for example. You can go public cloud, private cloud, or just adopt virtualization for server consolidation, continuity of operations, and disaster recovery. Now, if I understand the second question, which was impact of business driving the technical decisions. Let me think a minute about this. And if I put on my idle hat, then businesses should be involved in all technologies technology decisions. After all, technology decisions shouldn't be made in a vacuum, and there needs to be a strong business case to justify any decision. Again, I feel I'm overstating the obvious here. I apologize. Third question. Technology perspectives from a customer's point of view. Okay, customer's point of view. Well, that depends on the customer. Maybe I'm overly biased on delivering capability and quality, that to me, technology is a means to an end rather than an end in itself. So maybe from a marketing perspective, the customer would care. And personally, as an educated customer, I know I would care, knowing the advantages of one technology over the other. So it depends on the customer and the capability. Next question, our CIO is becoming Chief Innovation Officer. That's an interesting question. Chief Innovation Officer. That depends. The short answer is that, again, from an ITIL perspective, continual service improvement is part of a CIO's job. So innovation is essential to deliver improved IT services. Now, organizationally, how that is handled, again, that depends on the organization. And the last question, what are the other hot topics? Well, that's a rather open-ended question, and hot topics, well, we could talk about marketing hype or what I really think is important and relevant. So I'll defer to the trade publications and Gartner for hot topics, and let me restate something that I said earlier. From a CIO or CTO's perspective, I remain a strong advocate for change management. You can have the best technology, innovative capability with the highest quality, but if you don't transition it effectively, chances of it reaching its full potential are diminished. To quote a well-worn maxim, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. Metaphorically speaking, there is an art to creating thirsty horses and good-tasting water, as well as rewarding those who come to take the first drink, making it easy for them to find the water and tell their friends about how good it is. So change management is very important. And whether it's a hot topic or should be a hot topic and should be on your radar, I think it's essential. We'll leave it at that.
Well, you're truly a revolutionary gentleman, eclectic, and the master of so many domains. And I know that you're a professional musician, so in your opinion, how does music and technology complement each other?
Music to my ears. There's a chapter in my book titled The Same Old Song. It's actually chapter 12. And it suffices to say that I could write a symphony on this topic, pun intended. But let me start off rephrasing the question as, why are many of the most successful software developers also musicians? And from my perspective, I attribute a lot of it to what is commonly called the 10,000-hour rule. Now, I never heard of the 10,000-hour rule until about 3 or 4 months ago, but it really struck home. And that is, to be an accomplished musician, you need to have practiced 10,000 hours. And I will extrapolate this to software development, where I would hypothesize that to be an accomplished software developer, you would need to spend 10,000 hours writing software, which may or may not mean writing 10,000 lines of code in a particular domain or language. And whether I extrapolate that further to be an enterprise architect, that you would need 10,000 hours of systems analysis, familiarity with the various components of the system. I mean, you don't become a qualified system enterprise architect overnight. It does require looking at various aspects and familiarizing yourself with various trade-offs, various technology. So now, if you bear with me for a moment, I'm going to digress. I do have a point I'd like to make, and so I'll tell a little story here. In the first paper that I published, which was titled Computer Programming and the Human Thought Process, I was particularly impressed by the fact that there is no way, from an information bandwidth perspective, that a musician can sight-read music. Yet professional musicians do it all the time because their brain recognizes patterns and processes chunks of information at a time rather than individual notes. This is the same way we develop software in chunks or modules using information hiding and abstraction. And this is the way we build enterprise architectures from well-defined, configurable component interfaces. Now, I'm not sure I answered your question, but when it comes to creating an enterprise architecture, one needs to understand how to create harmony across all the components in order to integrate them smoothly, just like an orchestra is made up of many instruments, and the conductor must must keep musicians working in harmony. An enterprise architect must also keep the services working in harmony, marching to the beat of the same drummer, so to speak, or reading off the same score.
You know, you talk about the 10,000 hours, and I guess that refers to Malcolm Gladwell and his book Outliers. And my understanding of outliers and what makes for success is the 10,000 hour rule, that is putting that time commitment in. Having sufficient talent, that doesn't mean that you have to be the best in the field, but you have to have some sort of, you have to meet some sort of initial criteria of having sufficient talent. Creativity is an important element, and also having a good foundation and understanding the value of relationships. How do you see being creative? Do you find that being creative or having that creative element is also important in the IT field?
Well, I will compliment you on how you summarized and articulated those areas very well. And I will say in summary that connecting the dots. I mean, you've got to see the dot before you connect the dot. And connecting the dot in novel and innovative ways is being able to see where the gaps are or how you can make the gears mesh up slightly differently use the word synergy, where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. So all those aspects that you identified for preparing an individual to be innovative, the more prepared they are, the more deeper their understanding is, the deeper their toolbox, so to speak, that they can reach into to come up with a solution is, the more innovative they can be.
And we're down to our last series of questions here, and in this one I'm going to drill into all of the speaking and traveling you've done and all of the work you've done in so many parts of the world. So perhaps you have some stories you can share, maybe something that's amusing or amazing or surprising.
Well, I don't want to bore anyone with details, but yes, there's definitely many adventures, unplanned and unexpected events that have surfaced. Amusing, let's see. That would be the two-day Ryu seminar I was giving in Irvine, California, when in the middle of a lecture I noticed people ducking under the tables, and then I noticed the chandelier swinging back and forth. I was oblivious to the fact that we were experiencing an earthquake, but obviously the attendees had no trouble noticing. Must be my lecture wasn't that riveting. Amazing, well, what was amazing to me was the week I spent in Macau at the United Nations Institute. We were performing a study on sustainability in emerging nations. And I came in with my domain-specific software architecture perspective. And, let's just say it was eye-opening. And looking at all the problems and working with individuals from emerging nations in various continents, it helped me realize the need to focus my research, or I should say on communicating my research findings in terms that would be less academic but more broadly applicable to a more general set of opportunities in society. Surprising. Well, I don't know. I was surprised anyway when I received the bonus for when I completed the first satellite broadcast of a tutorial on software reuse by AMC and NTU in 1987. This was a two-day tutorial. It started on the East Coast. Of course, people who dialed in from the satellite didn't know, or didn't particularly affect them. Anyway, I started off on the East Coast at broadcast facilities at the University of Maryland, and I ended up the next day with an industry roundtable discussion on the West Coast at the HP facilities in Palo Alto, California. At the time, I really didn't think anything about the logistics of flying back and forth coast to coast, but it seemed to impress some people that this was occurring in this particular seminar. And I must admit, I'm grateful for the excellent participation from the representatives of HP, Schlumberger, and NTT who participated in that industry roundtable discussion. So amusing, amazing, surprising, maybe not that amazing, but those are the stories that come to mind.
I just really enjoy those stories. They're just... I don't know what other word to use. I'm amazed at everything that you do and all the kind of experiences that you've had over the years and are continuing to have. So,
yes.
Well, we're down to our last question, and this is where I turn the tables. And And that is, if you were doing this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Well, before I answer that question, let me just take the opportunity to thank you for giving me the opportunity to share with you some of my experiences. I hope some of the people who are listening can relate and maybe take something away from today's discussions. But the three questions that I would ask, and then what would I answer myself, would be, what advice do I have for managers? What advice do I have for software vendors? And then what advice do I have for software developers? And strange but true, I think I have the same basic answer to each of these questions, and that is, demand accountability. Be accountable. Expect quality. Expect to be expected to deliver quality. Three is a quote from American humorist Arnold H. Glasow. Success is simple. Do what's right, the right way, and at the right time. And thank you once again.
Well, that's a great way to end this interview. Oh, man, I mean, that was amazing. That was fantastic. And it's a good piece of advice, by the way, for those key stakeholders in our listener audience. And Will, I really appreciated you taking the time. You know, we have an acknowledged, recognized top global leader in multiple domains with so much experience and success history, willing to come in and share all of that history with our audience. So thank you for doing that, and it's very deeply appreciated.
You're welcome.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Dr. Will Trace, Lockheed Martin Fellow Emeritus, top global technology authority.